Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NAVA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety to tell his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. So I met Emily. She's very excited. I met Emily about 8 years ago at the Women's Mission downtown Atlanta. I was bringing a meeting with some other ladies, and she was there as a resident. And I just want to say that the promises are definitely coming true and working in her life. And she is a lovely example of how this program works successfully. So I give you Emily R. All right, thank you, everybody. I'm really excited to be here. This is where my sponsor comes. She comes to NAVA, and I've been here many, many times, and this is an awesome clubhouse, and I'm just really grateful, Lisa, for the opportunity to be here. And I always need a meeting, so this is awesome, except I'm going to start with my name. My name is Emily. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, and my last use, my recovery date is March 5th of 2015, so a little over 8 years, about 8.5 years. And so I'll just start by telling you who I am and where I came from. I came from Western Pennsylvania, a place called Johnstown, Pennsylvania. When I was growing up, the culture was my parents had cocktail parties. Like, drinking was just part of everything everybody did, you know. We had cocktail parties. They went to cocktail parties. Everybody in the neighborhood came over. Everybody was drinking beers on the weekend. It was just a part of my life. And then also, my brothers and sisters were of the generation where everybody was smoking weed. So they were in the basement smoking weed. And then one of the first smells I remember being 4 years old and smelling this wafting smell of pot coming up from our basement. And nobody ever said anything. It was just everybody just hung out in our basement and smoked weed. I didn't know what it was. I just thought it was part of, you know, my life. So those are my first experiences with drugs and alcohol. And when I was 7, I had some traumatic experience happen, and it kind of changed my view, and it changed my trust of people and in certain situations. And so it made me want to change the way I felt, you know. And so by the time I was 13 and I could get access to my parents' liquor cabinet, which was fully stocked with stuff they got for Christmas that they didn't drink, you know. They were martini drinkers, so it was like all the other stuff that was in there. By the time I was 13, my birthday's the first week in January. So that New Year's Eve when I was 13, about to turn 14, I really had a bad experience with both drinking and using other substances, and that's really where my drinking career started. And that, I hate to say it, but a week later I was in the hospital for trying to attempt suicide because it was that bad. So that's how it started, and then I started having this alcoholic behavior because I loved the way alcohol changed my life and changed my feeling and numbed everything. You know, I didn't want to feel anything. And I didn't like school. I mean, I loved school, but I didn't like the people in school. I didn't feel like I fit in. I never felt like I fit in with any. I was just drinking and doing other substances throughout high school, barely graduated. I mean, I squeaked by. The two of my best friends that I hung out with, neither one of them made it to graduation. They had to do summer school, so I think eventually they got their diplomas. But I mean, I just very barely made it. And because it was getting in the way of my drinking. I mean, literally, like if I, you know, I was full-blown alcoholic by the time I graduated from high school. So I want to read something real quick, and then I'll keep going. So this is on page 20. Oh, it's actually on the Roman numeral section, but it's page 28 of the Roman numeral. It's the doctor's opinion. So it says, men and women, this is at the bottom of the page, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit that it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems to be the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. So I have that underlined in both yellow and orange highlighter. I love this book, by the way. It's all marked up. I have all my sponsors that I've worked with in the front, and then I have my pages and the principles behind the pages. So I'll be referring to my big book. The reason why I bring that up is because that's what I experienced, you know, with that craving, that feeling of just bliss when I was using or drinking. In the early 1990s, I tried to go to school. Now that I graduated from high school, I did try to go to college. But again, it got in the way of my drinking. My grades were good, but I wanted to go make money so that I could party. That was really, I was that person who went to and asked the fraternity brothers to leave the keg available for me. No one else. I wouldn't have any friends or anything with me. It was just me asking them if I could drink from the keg. Every day. And so again, it got in the way of my drinking. So when I was a sophomore, I dropped out and I went back to work. So now I want to read something else. And this is from There is a Solution on page 21. It says, how many people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fellow can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl. I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Right? So I when I read through this book, I'm like, there's so many things in it that I can relate to. And then I want to read one more thing on here on page 22, where it says, down at the bottom of the page, it says, we are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. I'm just like, that's me. There's so many passages in this book. At this point, now that I dropped out of school, I'm working, and I'm drinking every opportunity that I can afford and get. And I met a man in a bar. Imagine that. And he's a cute guy, and next thing you know, I got pregnant. And then, so I had a baby girl. I was able to kind of quit drinking while I was pregnant. Once I found out I was pregnant, but as soon as she was born, I started drinking again. It was like as soon as humanly possible. And then I got pregnant again. And then I was able to quit drinking while I was pregnant, but again, started drinking as soon as my son was born. And then we got married. So if I could do it the wrong way, it was going to happen. And then within a year and a half later, we were divorced. He was able to understand the concept that he needed to not, he could do the weekend partying Friday and Saturday night, but he could stop on Sunday because he knew he had to go to work on Monday. I didn't understand that. That wasn't something I could do. So I had brief periods of abstinence from alcohol, but they were very brief and few and far between. So at this point, I'm now a single mom, and I decided that it was time to go back to college. So I went back to school, and even with my drinking being kind of out of control, I was still able to finish with a lot of help from my parents. My parents helped me out with the kids and stuff, and I really liked school, so I really made an effort to stick it out. And then, but the thing is, on the weekends, I was a waitress and a bartender. Imagine that. So, you know, I would get off of work, and I work in a bar. What am I going to do as soon as I get done working, right? I mean, it was unbelievable. So it was a great experience. It was kind of bittersweet. It was a great experience being in that environment, but at the same time, it was absolutely terrible for my alcoholism, really, really bad. So I ended up graduating from college. I was able to get my bachelor's degree, and then I got a great job with benefits. And so things were starting to look up. I was working towards buying a home. I was renting to own a house for my parents, but I couldn't stop partying. I literally couldn't stop partying. And part of the culture at my job was a lot of drinking. We would go out to happy hours and stuff like that, and it was just all part of what we did. So it was getting pretty out of control. I was able to stick out my job for about 4 or 5 years, and then finally I literally had to go to rehab. I just couldn't deal anymore. I started missing work, and I remember my son, this is so sad, but I remember my son saying to me, "Mom, are you ever going to do laundry again?" And he didn't have any clean clothes to wear at school, you know? I mean, I couldn't even, it just got really, really bad. So I tried to go to rehab for the 28 days. I came back 2 days early, and I tried to go back to work, and they said, "You know, you didn't finish rehab." And I said, "Well, but I only came home 2 days early." And they said, "It doesn't matter. You have to go back to rehab." And I couldn't go back to rehab. So at that point, my mom said that my kids had to go because I wasn't a fit mom anymore. And she said if I didn't give up my children to my ex-husband, that she was going to call DFACS and have them taken away from me. I didn't have much of a choice in that. So my kids moved on, and their dad's wonderful, you know, and he did take them in. And then I had to put my house on the market because I didn't have a job. I couldn't pay for the house anymore. So that's when I did the geographical change. Anybody else relate to the geographical change? I was like, okay, it's this town. That's the problem. I can't get sober because I live in this town. So I decided I was going to move with my girlfriend who lives up in Massachusetts. And I thought, well, that's plenty of by change, you know, a couple states away. I'm going to get a good start. Everything's going to be great. What does she do when she greets me at the door with a glass of wine, right? I'm like, this is a great start. So then I was off to the races again there in New England, and I did several changes. Massachusetts. I moved to Rhode Island for a little while, moved to New Hampshire for a little while, and then finally it got too cold up there. It was a great place, but it just was too cold. I moved to Virginia because I thought that that would be a great group geographical change. I would go down there and I would get my act together and start over again. What happened when I got to Virginia was my life literally fell apart. It got so bad. I got a great job again, got a great job working for a wonderful company, and I just could not stay sober. So I eventually lost that job, and I wasn't able to get another employee. You know, I couldn't stay sober long enough to get a job. So I ended up homeless. And I was living in Norfolk, Virginia, on the streets for about a year. And then if anyone has ever been homeless before, it's very easy to start getting into criminal activity, which I did. And next thing you know, I ended up spending a lot of time in jail, in the Norfolk City Jail. And then I caught felony charges, and I was let out on probation, and I had a choice. You can either turn yourself in, go to court, they'll probably give me probation, whatever. But, you know, knowing my my history, my track record, my choice was to run. Why not, right? I'm going to run. So I met someone, didn't know that person. I just said, I need to run. And he said, okay. And so we ran. And so then we left Norfolk and went down to Florida by way of Atlanta. So that was my first taste of Atlanta. Was all, you know, alcohol and other substances, going down to Florida. And then when we got down to Florida, everything fell apart, and we started coming back, and the car broke down in Atlanta. So here I am back in Atlanta. And then we tried to go to Athens. He had a friend in Athens, and I was going to really, really try to get to recovery in Athens. So that was going to be the plan. So I go to Athens, and then it was a complete hot mess. This person had literally warrants in like four different states, one of them being Georgia. And so, of course, we got pulled over, and they immediately took him to jail and left me there in Athens. He gave me a little bit of money and a cell phone and said, see ya. So I'm in Athens by myself. I didn't know anyone. And I ended up homeless in Athens for another 7 years, from 2008 to 2015. And, of course, part of that being homeless was living the lifestyle and in and out of jail again. I spent a lot of time in Athens, Clark County Jail. As a matter of fact, when people would ask me what my address was, I would say 3015 Lexington Road, because that is the address of the jail. And I had no contact with any of my family at this point, and I will tell you that during this period, my father passed away, and I was not able to be there to help with any of that and to be there to support him or my mom or my brothers and sisters during that time at all. But when I was in jail in 2014, my brother passed away. I got a letter while I was sitting at lunch from my mother, who would always write to me when I was in jail, and let me know that my brother had passed. And he was a wonderful guy. He was always very supportive of my, you know, my life, trying to help me get into recovery. And it did something. That there was some kind of a moment there where my higher power spoke to me and said, I don't have to do this anymore. And so at that point, I really did try to get into some recovery environments. I started going to 12-step meetings at the Biscayne Room. Anybody, I don't know if you've ever been there, but have you been there to the Biscayne Room in Athens? Yeah, so it's not there anymore, but it was a great clubhouse. Started going to meetings there. And I also started going into a sober living facility. And so some of those seeds got planted in me that this might actually be possible. I could actually get, you know, some help. When I got out of jail on January 29th of 2015, I was told by the Athens Clark County Police that I had 12 hours to leave the county. I was barred from the county for 2 years. They were like, get out of our town. Just go, I don't care where you go, just go somewhere. Don't stay here. I went to a ministry called the Sparrow's Nest. It's run by a man named Jamie Scott. He's amazing. He didn't know me from a can of paint. I walked up to him and I said, sir, I said, I'm desperate. I need some help. I have to leave. And he asked me what I needed, and I said, I really need a megabus ticket to get to Atlanta to get some help. Right? And he said, no questions. Absolutely. He couldn't have been any nicer. He's like, sure, no problem. I couldn't believe somebody would do something nice for me like that and not have a transactional, you know, relationship with it, not ask for anything. But he did. And so I got on that bus, and I almost didn't. Boy, I mean, I was so close to not getting on the bus, but I did. And I came to Atlanta, and I was able to jump around from home. I went to the, Peachtree and Pine for a week, and then I went out to a place in Forest Park for about 3 weeks, and then I finally made it into my sister's house at the Atlanta Union Mission, which is a homeless shelter. But at that time, they had what was called a personal development program. And so at first I got into the shelter, and I knew I could get something there. So I went into this ambassador's office, and she said, you know, she handed me a women's devotional Bible and asked me if I wanted to do something different. And I was like, at this point, you know, it's freezing cold out. This is the end of February in Atlanta. It was so cold. I was like, heck yeah. I just want a place to sleep. I don't want to do this anymore. And so I started this program, and one of the very first things that happened was this AA meeting in the basement. And Lisa and a bunch of ladies would come down to this room in the basement of the homeless shelter and have this AA meeting. It was the best day of my life. It was just the best day of my week. It was the perfect way to start the week off, because what would happen is these ladies would come, they would do the meeting, and then they would get up and go somewhere. They would get up, leave, go get in their cars, and go home. And I'm like, that's what I want. I want to be them. That's what I want out of this. You know, that's what I remember about it. And so what I did was I approached one of these ladies to ask her if she would be my sponsor. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say her name. Okay, so Fran is Fran. She comes to NAVA regularly. And she's still my sponsor. She's still my sponsor to this day. And she would come. I attended every Monday night meeting. And then we started working through the steps. And she would come, and she would get off of work, and she would come and meet with me, and we would go down in one of the rooms in the homeless shelter, and we would sit down there for an hour and do step work. And she helped me so much. I mean, I don't know how I would have made it without that meeting. I literally don't know how I would have made it, because the program was difficult, you know. I don't know how many of you have had an experience with treatment program, but it is not easy to get along with those other people in there, right? Because we're all, you know what I mean, right? It's like, man, it was tough. But anyway, she really helped me, and the meeting really helped me. So let me see where I got. I got kind of, oh, here. Okay, so I'm at, this is what I wanted to read to you, too. And this is a good spot for this. This is on page 25. There is a solution. It says here on page 25, there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings, which the process requires for successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others. And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have seen it rocket. We have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence for which we had not even dreamed. And that's where it really started to happen for me. I love this book. So again, also what I did during that period is I found a home group. It was on 10th Street, not the one that's still in existence, but it was another one that was in the church basement, and it was a candlelight meeting. It was so cool. It was so cool. Saturday night, go down there, and they'd light the candles, and we'd have our meeting and stuff. It was just an incredible experience. And I graduated from that program in December of 2015. I was able to start working a full-time job at Home Depot. Love that place. And then I was able to start connecting with my family at that point. And I started doing service work. And I started going to Sunrise Detox Facility on Tuesdays and taking a meeting into folks who have less than 2 weeks in recovery at the detox facility. And that was a really rewarding experience. I started sponsoring. I got my very first sponsor in 2016. Her name is Charlotte. And sure enough, right before I was getting ready to leave tonight, she called me. It's like, it's a higher power thing, you know? Like, out of the blue, she called me. I mean, we talked regularly, but it was just weird that she called me 15 minutes before I'm getting ready to come tell my story here, you know? She's lovely. And so I have 5 sponsees. But that's when I started. In 2016, I started sponsoring folks. And I also got my own apartment with a roommate at that point. So I was living with my grand sponsor for a while, which is Fran's sponsor, and she was gracious enough to help me out because I had to get out of the homeless shelter, you know, because I graduated the program. I needed somewhere to go, and I didn't have any money. I mean, I was working at Kroger making $7.25 an hour. I had no money. So until I could get started working at Home Depot, and then I was able to get a roommate. And then, in 2017, I got a job in recovery. I went to this training program that I really enjoyed, and I started to get this cool job in recovery. And I started working on a federal grant. Oh, I forgot to tell y'all, I still have those active felony warrants in Virginia, right? I still have them. Not now, but in 2017, I still have them. So when I got hired at this place, they were going to put me on a state grant, but I couldn't pass a background check, right? So she put me on a federal grant, and they wouldn't do a background check. But the grants officer wanted me fired because she found out I got these felony active warrants against me. So long story short, the next year, I was able to go back with Fran, and she helped me, and I went and turned myself in, and I was able to get all that stuff taken care of in 2018. So I am a felon, but I don't have any active warrants against me anymore. And I'm no longer on probation in Athens. I'm allowed to go to Athens now. Well, I can do that. So there's that. And then, so I went back there, yep. And then I also, that year, I started visiting my mom. My mom didn't want to have anything to do with me. She was terrified of me because I brought so much drama and so much chaos to her life that she really didn't want to have anything to do with me. She was terrified. But in 2018, she started accepting me, and she let me come back up and start visiting her again. And then also, in 2019, my grandson was born. I have a grandbaby son. Thank you. And, any other grandparents? Yay! I love being a grandma. He was born in Louisiana, and I was able to be there and for that experience. And then also in 2019, I was able to go back to school and get my MBA. So there's that. So, all gifts of recovery, right? Miracles kept coming. And then in 2020, I was able to get promoted at work, and I was able to go to Costa Rica and spend my 5 year. I landed in Costa Rica on my 5 year, on March 5th of 2020. What was that? I went to an AA meeting in Costa Rica, y'all. It was so cool. So cool. Highly recommend it. So today, my life, I'm on track for another promotion at work eventually. I have a very special person then in my life today. And I also love to hike with my dog. I love to travel. I have a lot of wonderful friends. And I spend a lot of time with my kids and my grandson. And I'm also able to work with my brothers and sisters to help get my mom into an assisted living home, which is where I'll be next week. I got to go in and move her in to this home next week. I would have never been able to do that a few years ago, you know? I mean, it's like there's no way I would have been able, I wouldn't have been welcome. I wouldn't have been part of their lives. I would not have had any experience with my mom whatsoever. And now it's like she called me every day. She drives me crazy, but I'd rather have that than not. And then I'm also, I support my, I work with my siblings today, to stay connected with them. And I will tell you, it's not a perfect life. I still have a lot of things that I have to work on with my son because there was a lot of damage done there and he felt very abandoned. And I think that's going to have some long-term effects in the relationships that he has going forward. That generational type of trauma and stuff was carried over to him, but we work on it today and we talk. And when I go down there to visit him, I make sure that I spend time just talking to him and no one else around. And for a while, that was difficult because he didn't want to be around me either, but that's gotten so much better. Every day is a new opportunity to help, restore relationships and help provide service to other people who might be looking for support, I see that today in my life because that's what other people did for me. And I want to give that to as many people as I possibly can. And then I have another reading. So this is one of the things I do want to say about living in that. If anybody's in treatment or knows anybody in treatment, how difficult it is to be around other people and situations because or even now today, I have situations at work that come up, or situations with my mom. My mom, she's 89, and she's not very nice anymore. She is not nice. She'll have moments where she is, but it really is difficult to deal with her. And I lose my patience sometimes, you know, and I'm like, what do I do? What if I can't call Fran? That's my answer to everything, call Fran. But I want to read this. This is Acceptance Was the Answer. It's on page 417. I'm sure most of you are familiar with this reading. So it says, "In acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I'm disturbed, it is because I find some person, place, thing, or situation, some fact of my life, unacceptable to me. And I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing, or situation as being exactly the way it was supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Until I can accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as what needs to be changed in me and my attitudes." I think I'm finished just a little early, but if that's okay, that's all I've got. And thanks for letting me share.
Do you mind if people have any questions for you?
Yeah, yeah, it's fine.
You guys can go about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Do you guys have any questions or comments for anyone?
Your dad, did you have a relationship with your dad at all? Is he still living? And if he is, what age did he die?
That's a great question, Robert. He passed in 2010. Yeah, and he was 79 when he passed away. And we were very close. I was his only daughter. So I'm out of, you know, mixed family where we got, I have brothers, two brothers that were from a different mom, and I had two sisters that were from a different dad, and I was my dad's only daughter, so we were super close, and it was all that shame and guilt and everything. I was embarrassed to talk to him because he was always so kind and loving to me, and he passed away, and I was in full-blown alcoholism, as an addiction, and I wasn't there. So, yeah, that was
that. Yes, ma'am. Hi, thank you so much for telling your story. I'm Ellen. I'm an alcoholic. I really felt some hope in your story about your son. I've been here since 2013, and a lot of people in the rooms know that I to this day don't have a relationship with him, and he wants nothing to do with me. And I have an older son who was there until I relapsed, and then once I relapsed, he just kind of went the same way. And so it's very difficult to try to keep the hope that one day that will heal itself. What steps do you take with your son as far as, like, reassuring him that you wouldn't go back by choice to the things that you said and did and in the past, and how do you move forward with letting them know and getting the trust back for them that, you know, they lost in me. You know, I don't, even if they were to come today and call and say, hey, I'm ready to meet, it's going to take a lot for me to prepare myself so that I don't come in with the same excuses that I did all those years.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's a great question. What I did is, so they live in Louisiana, right? And so when I would go there at first, I knew exactly where the AA meeting was. I really did. I had to go. And there were a couple times where I almost left and came home because I didn't feel like I was welcome, you know, like I thought I was going to be. I, you know, how you go into something having certain expectations. And it was very difficult at first, no lie. It was really very, very difficult. I went to AA meetings. I got in my car a few times and almost left. But then my daughter said, you know, Mom, that's your answer to everything. You just leave. And I was like, well, I can't do that. Yeah. So we really had to work on it. And my son and I like I said, my big deal with him, what I've learned is there for a while his dad was protective of him, and he wouldn't really let me have a conversation alone with him. And I don't think my son wanted to have a conversation with me alone. He didn't feel comfortable. So it's been a process. But it's been literally 5 years of just, you know, we get closer and closer. And so this last year, I was able to go just, he lives in New Orleans, and so I went just to New Orleans and spent time with just him. Just me and him. His dad wasn't there. His sister wasn't there. There was no distraction. And it was on his terms. Mm-hmm. So I was in his town. Mm-hmm. I was on his terms. He showed me what he wanted to keep. You know, I let him guide everything. Because the more I try to push on him, mm-hmm. he just won't. He won't respond to text messages. He won't respond to anything. Mm-hmm. But as long as I put it on his terms and let him, you know, figure out what works best for him, it seems like it's getting better. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not there yet, but right. It's way better than it was.
Yeah. You know, so I've just had several people say, "Why don't you just show up at his door?" And I'm like, "I'll tell you why. Because if he slams it in my face, I'm gonna go drink."
Yeah.
I will. Because that would be the only way I would be able to handle that just rejection. I don't know if it's better for me to stay away and just let God do his work, which is what I'm supposed to do. You know, sometimes I wonder, like, do I take somebody with me and just show up, you know? And then if he rejects me, then I have that person there to help me. But, you know, I just wondered what.
I did letters, too.
Yeah, I do cards.
Yeah.
I do a lot of cards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've done that.
But
thank you. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Put on the stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I can relate to what you said about probation and stuff like that and felonies. Because when I came here, May the 9th, 2011, I was on parole. And this is a town that I didn't like neither. It's only by the grace of God that I got a sponsor saying that I got here. I got off parole here, and I was on electronic monitor. You know, I didn't have nothing to lose. I just wanted to let you know that stick with what you're sponsoring, whatever you're doing, it will work out. That's it.
Thank you.
My name is Mark, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
Thanks for your story. I can relate to the hardship of being homeless, and I'm an alumni of the Atlanta Union Mission, and I used to go over to my sister's place. I took a friend I used to date when I was active. When I got sober, I went all to all them girls I used to get high with. I had a van. I took them all to treatment. And one girl, she went to treatment, and all her friends, they followed suit. A lot of them started getting sober. Anyway, I'm glad you went to a faith-based program because that's all we had to do. Was, you know, I believe, truly believe that the music, when we went to church every day and we went to meetings, that had a lot to do with me. They got a picture of me in their newsletter, me singing. And that truly helped me realize that, you know, I'm sick and tired of the starting over. I went in and out of this clubhouse right here 6 years. I never detoxed until I went to the Atlanta Union Mission. I was sorry to hear that they took the union out of the mission.
Yeah.
But, you know, I kind of understand why they did that because a lot of people was donating a lot of money there. And the counselors and everything was pocketing a lot of that stuff. So, but anyway, I'll think about the word faith, you know. Faith had to grow in order to allow you to believe that you could do this. You saw it working on other people. You know, I started visualizing. I said, yeah, you know. So it's one day at a time. And I just think about the faith that, you know, that grows when we are being around a faith-based environment, you know. And we believe in ourselves, you know. Says, without faith, it's impossible to please. God is in us. So when we have faith enough to know that God is with us every day, you know, we can overcome. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Hey, Emily, I'm just going to make this fast, even though I'm about to get there. You are such an inspiration to me. You were an inspiration when I met you, when you were still homeless in the place because of your attitude, okay? So this, I feel like this program is here for me and whoever avails themselves of it, if they want it, if they do it, if they let it happen. And I'm so happy for you in your journey. I'm so happy for you. And you're the same lovely person, just way more, you know, mature than when I first met you, and, you know, sober and lovely. And I just love your enthusiasm for the program. So I still have it myself. So, and I just love it. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks. Hey, real quick, Emily, I'll tell them I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much. But I love to ask people this question, and it's such a wonderful story. But, you know, it says our story is disclosed in a general way, what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you had to succinctly say, as best you can, what happened?
I had a spiritual experience, I think. I know I did. That's what happened. And I found a program that helped save my life, you know, and people and the fellowship, really. And yeah, that's what happened.
I know. For me, it was the willingness to open up and listen and try it. You know, because it wasn't there for years, and all of a sudden it was.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a great question.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Okay.
I just said something really fast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's okay.
Sure. Sure.
You both can.
I'm so grateful that you guys are saying it. Thank you for sharing it. And I'd like to know whether or not it has been featured in the Grapevine publication. I think it's Grapevine worthy.
Oh, you're so happy.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm an alcoholic. Oh, yeah. You're just inspired.
I love you
too. Thank you. Thank you. You touched a lot of people in the room tonight.
I used to hate my pain. Avoid the feelings like a winter rain. I'd run away, hiding the hurt with a drink or an angry word, until the day I could not deny the healing calling from deep inside. It was a love that was here to mend my broken heart. Could be my friend. On the other side, I will rise above the mountains, here to climb. As I grow, I stumble and I fall, but I am grateful for it all. On the other side, there is peace beneath the pain. A tender tear that I can't explain, washing away the fearful wounds, bearing a light for my life to bloom. On the other side, I will rise above the mountains. I must climb. As I grow, I stumble and I fall. I
father.